Hello, I'm Guy Foster, and in this week's podcast, I'm speaking to Dr. Eamon Butler, a longtime advocate of freeports and a member of the government's Freeport Advisory Panel. Now, freeports may end up being the most exciting thing that was announced at this week's budget. Alternatively, they could turn out to be something of a damp squib, and it all depends on how they get implemented, which is what we're going to talk about in a moment. But bear in mind, we can't guarantee sources from outside Bruendorf, and tax legislation and allowances can change. And remember, when investing, your capital is at risk. Investment values can increase or decrease because of currency fluctuations, and future performance can differ from that of the past. So, having made the announcement, how does the government go about getting this right? To find out, stay tuned in just a few moments. Hello, and welcome to another edition of the Bruin Podcast with me, Guy Foster, Chief Strategist here at Bruin Dolphin. And this week's budget saw a lot of support for business and households while the economy recovers from COVID. And that was coupled with a big threat or a promise of an increase in corporation tax a few years down the road. That seems a far cry from the kind of Singapore on Thames vision, which many had advocated as a rationale for Brexit. But then the Chancellor mentioned some attractive allowances and also notably the new freeports. And we're left wondering whether the phase three of his plan, the building our economy of the future, might actually be a transformational one after all. So in order to try and answer that question, I'm thrilled to be joined by Dr. Eamon Butler, who literally wrote the book on freeports back in 1983, I believe. So Dr. Butler is one of the founders of the Adam Smith Institute, which promotes free market ideas, and has featured on the podcast in the past. He was also appointed to the Freeport Advisory Panel in 2019, whose work presumably has contributed to this announcement. So, Dr. Butler, welcome to the podcast. Thanks for joining us.
Yes, thanks, Guy. It's good to be here.
Brilliant. Perhaps you could start by just indulging our ignorance and giving us a sort of a guide to what a freeport means, sort of in principle, if that's all right.
Yes, it's not an easy idea. But the basic idea is that it's an area that you designate, usually around an airport or a seaport, where there are no customs duties. And that means that you can bring goods in, you can work on them, you know, for example, you can process them or assemble components and label things, package things, and then re-export them without facing any customs or customs paperwork. Customs are only paid when they go into a third country or when they go from the freeport into, in this case, the United Kingdom. And there are about 3,500 freeports in 135 countries all over the world, employing about 66 million people. They often have other concessions as well, like tax reliefs and special development easements and things like that, in order to try to create a sort of business hub that's almost, if you like, outside the customs area of the country.
Well, you just mentioned that there are a lot of these around the world. So can you give some examples of where the concept's been really well used?
Well, Shannon in Southern Ireland is a very good example, very close to us, of course. That's brought in new trade. It's created a self-sustaining economic hub, a sort of productive community. You know, clearly it's something which was started for one purpose has actually grown into a sort of industrial city. But there are many other examples. The United States has hundreds of free trade zones, as they call them. You've got, again, near to us, you've got Rotterdam, Cadiz. Further afield, Dubai has been very energetic in creating lots of free zones, with very generous tax concessions for people who invest in them.
And is this, is this the kind of thing that people mean when they talk about the UK potentially becoming a sort of Singapore on Thames kind of free trading country?
Well, yes, Singapore and indeed Hong Kong both benefited from freeport status. They haven't got much else going for them. They're very small places and you know, they don't have much in the way of natural resource. But those are now two of the richest places on the planet, largely because of their trade. And the question for me, when I'm thinking about free ports, is why we don't turn the whole country into a free port. And I think the government's view is that, well, you have to demonstrate that this does actually work before you can roll it out more generally.
And so the principle there then, presumably, is that it's like this kind of Laffer curve idea that actually you can improve your finances by having lower taxes and more economic activity as a result.
Yes, you're trying to bring in new trade from other places in the world, which wouldn't come to you otherwise. It's a big world out there. As I say, there are 3,500 free ports. Trade is mobile. It can go to anywhere in the world. You've got to have a really good offer. And if you can offer people, well, they can bring goods in, they can process them, they can re-export them, and they don't face any paperwork at all. And maybe there are other benefits to creating new buildings that they need and things like that, or paying less national insurance, things like that. Then you bring in new trade that wouldn't otherwise have come to this country, and that is a stimulus for the whole economy.
So every budget, there seems to be some sort of variation on an enterprise zone or something similar, which seeks to revitalise some region of the UK. Do you think this is sort of tangibly different from what we've seen many times before?
Well, it's interesting that the Prime Minister is very committed to it. He, after the last election, on the steps of Downing Street as he went in, it was one of his promises. And the Chancellor, Rishi Sunak, has actually written a report when he was a backbencher calling for free ports. So he's in favour of it as well. So it's got very strong push from the top. And I think that the Prime Minister in particular, well, both of them really, see it as a demonstration of a sort of free market philosophy, free enterprise in action. And so I think it's different because I think they're likely to ensure that free ports are actually genuinely free. In the last wave, which was from 1984 to 2012, there were half a dozen or so free ports were created then, but the Treasury wouldn't concede an inch on things like VAT reliefs or customs paperwork or any other reliefs. So, and there was no central government support for businesses like the Infrastructure Bank, which the Chancellor has announced. And so there was very little going for them. And enterprise zones themselves, again, really became subsidy islands rather than enterprise zones. So this time, I think it is different. I think that people, we understand the experience of the last wave and what went wrong in so many cases. And we've got that commitment from the top to actually make it work and demonstrate that free markets and free enterprise will actually produce the goods.
Now, I was looking through the details, such as it is of the announcement that came with the budget, and there were, you know, some seemingly very significant features: capital allowances for plant and buildings, full relief on stamp duty, full relief on business rates, potentially an exemption from the employer's national insurance contributions. I mean, are these the right kinds of things? I suppose I don't think there's been any reference to VAT that you mentioned. And I mean, maybe the commitments to duty wasn't explicitly stated. Maybe that goes without saying, does it?
Well, yes, the Freeports announcement was supposed to be made in April. That was the timetable. But I think the Chancellor decided that in his March budget, he needed a little bit more good news and looking more to the future. So the announcement was made without all of these details being confirmed. So, yes, we are expecting a range of reliefs from various taxes and easements on planning and things like that. You have to make sure that this just doesn't become a sort of property driven thing, that you designate an area and there's less planning control and therefore everybody goes there. That's to some extent what happened in the first wave. But then again, you do need new buildings and infrastructure on old industrial sites around many of our old ports. And so, yes, you do need things like structures and building allowance easements. You need stamp duty land tax easements. All of that is great. And I'd certainly like to see relief on business rates as well. And national insurance, as you mentioned, that's a tax on employment. I mean, let's have an experiment where we have a much lower tax on employment and see what happens. I think you're going to get more employment myself. In terms of VAT, we have to get VAT right. And I think the only way to do this, frankly, is to treat free ports as if they're foreign territory. And don't try to levy tax on transactions within the free port. Within a free port, there can be dozens, hundreds even, of companies all swapping goods and indeed services between each other. And that really, you should put a ring fence around that and just say that's foreign territory. We're not going to impose VAT on those transactions. And that's what a lot of other countries do, and we should be doing the same. And we have to do the same if we're going to be competitive with other people. Last time, as I said, the revenue didn't concede an inch. And so individual firms in the Freeport had to do their own VAT and register and all the rest of it. It wasn't even that the Freeport operator could handle all of the VAT. Everybody had to do it themselves. So that was a major problem, I think. And I think getting VAT right is going to be a key indicator as to whether the Freeport idea is going to work or not.
Apart from these financial measures, what else would you want to see? I mean, you've kind of talked about bureaucracy, so reduced bureaucracy perhaps is part of that. I mean, can Freeports override the sort of NIMBYism which often holds back particularly property developments in other areas?
Well, two questions there. I think the more we can simplify customs, the better. And if you're going to have tax reliefs on things, then let's not have complicated forms that just make it not worthwhile even applying. Also, I think you need some marketing support from central government, trade fairs, working through embassies to actually tell people that we've got these free ports and we have these opportunities and they should move business to us. And then after that, I think you let the free ports work out their own USP. You don't push them into one thing like, oh, you have to do green energy or something, if it doesn't actually work for them. Let them find it. It's got to be market driven. It's got to be trade driven. And I think actually you could also allow virtual free ports. There's no reason why we're talking about areas that have got a barbed wire fence around them. These days, you can have virtual free ports and ports themselves can link up with universities, for example, to produce and exploit leading edge technology. As for the NIMBYism thing, well, yes, I mean, free port as it's being imagined at the moment is a defined area, usually around the ones that are chosen are mostly areas that do need development and investment. So I think there's not going to be too much. There's always NIMBYism, but I don't think there's going to be too much on this. And if the new infrastructure bank can come up with some funding to put in new links to places like Harwich, for example, which really does need new access, then I think that's all to the good.
So one of the things that struck me about the detail again is that a lot of the tax measures are quite time limited. So I suppose that creates a bit of urgency. I wonder, would it be more effective if the benefits were enduring?
Well, yes, it would. The government, I think, hopes for a kind of Shannon experience where you create the conditions for a cluster to build itself up, and then that becomes self-sustaining and you can walk away. Yes, I think the aim should certainly be to build up those clusters. And then I think what you've got to do is to take the same low tax and low regulation measures out more widely. So, you know, don't just have low taxes, low regulations, and then stop after a couple of years. Do it, see if it works. And if it does work, then spread it to other places.
Can a government ensure that this doesn't result in just shifting business and a drain from other regions, which might not be too high flying anyway?
Well, not easily. And that has been a concern which many people have voiced. But the government's been very keen to specify in its tender document, it had about 30 people applying for a possibility of 10 free ports. It's specified in the tender documents that the jobs that are going to be created can't simply be displaced from other places. They have to demonstrate that they're creating new and indeed high value jobs. Last time in the first wave of free ports, firstly, they produced about a quarter of the employment that we were hoping for, partly because they were so tightly regulated. But about a third of the jobs they did create were simply transferred from other places in the United Kingdom, and mostly low-grade jobs at that. So the aim is different, and the government, I think, is conscious of a business simply upping sticks and moving to free ports. And I think they know, or at least I'm certainly telling them, that our free ports have to be attractive on an international level in order to attract new business into the country rather than just shift business around the country. So that means that they've got to be robust in their offer, and a half-hearted version simply won't do.
Now, another thing that you mentioned earlier was the idea of these sort of virtual free ports. And do you think the kind of new work environment that we're all sort of trying to understand and anticipate on the other side of COVID, where sort of physical proximity is less important, does it make it easier to kind of build these clusters in the kinds of places where the government wants to see them emerge?
Well, I think that's a very good point, actually. I mean, many of us find that we can work from anywhere in the world, really. So you don't necessarily have to have an area around a port with a barbed wire fence. You can have employees all over the country. Now, that's to some extent not what the government wants to do. The government wants to create jobs in places that need investment and employment. So I think you have to be careful about it. But yes, I think it is a huge opportunity. And as I say, you know, getting some creative brains in from universities, for example, and they can collaborate with producers and processors in a free port, be it around an airport or a seaport, very easily in many ways.
So, and then another thing that you mentioned earlier was, you know, that in the past these things have turned into sort of, I can't remember what language you used, subsidy zones or something. So how does the government stay on the right side of the sort of international fair competition rules? What would it take for this to trigger complaints to the WTO or more fractured relationships with the EU?
Yeah, that's the more likely one. Well, as I say, nearly every country has free ports or free zones of one sort or another. It's not the existence of free ports that's the problem. The problem for everyone is whether you subsidize your export industries. But that's not really what free ports are for. They're for processing goods free of customs duties. They're not exactly for promoting export industries. So I think that all of the concessions should pass muster. The WTO has its own rules, which we, of course, have to abide by. But I think probably the biggest restraint on not over-egging this would be the European Union, because it would be perfectly in character for them to impose sanctions if they felt that British free ports were eating into their trade or damaging their producers. And that's even despite the fact that there are around 80 free ports in the EU already. So there are limits to what you can do, but as long as you are careful not to subsidize your export trades and try to get round trade barriers that way, then you should be okay.
Okay, well, look, you've been very generous with your time, but if I could just ask one more question before we wrap up. You know, another thing announced at the budget, as I mentioned in the intro, is this sharp increase in corporation tax, albeit not for a couple of years. And it's a move which raises revenue from those who can pay, possibly by then from those who have had a lot of support. So I'm sure the public find it kind of very easy to understand and probably quite supportable. But when it happens, we may end up with a corporation tax rate that's, say, twice that of Ireland. Do you think that at a sort of national level kind of undermines the benefits that we might have in these specific free ports?
Well, it undermines those benefits, but it undermines benefits not just in free ports. High corporation taxes hit new business creation in particular, and we need new business. And free ports are about creating new business, but we need new businesses to fill the holes that lockdown and COVID have created in our economic fabric. Business taxes greatly increase the risk of anyone setting up and growing a new business. So I worry that the corporation tax increase will discourage entrepreneurs. And sure, the tax rise is 2 years off, but you know, people know it can take 2 years to get a business up and running and start to make a profit. And all entrepreneurs think that they're going to be making huge profits. So they think they're going to be hit by this tax. So it's a really bad idea. And when you look at all of the reliefs and things that other countries impose on their apply to their corporation taxes, actually our corporation tax will be one of probably the highest, I think, in the G7 and among the growing nations. So that's bad, and I think the Chancellor really ought to know better.
Okay, all right. Well, thank you very much, Dr. Butler. Really, really interesting. I probably should have engineered that so that we ended on a slightly happier note than that last one, but an important point, of course. So thanks very much for joining us, and thanks also to all of our listeners. Hopefully you found this journey into the world of free ports really, really interesting and exciting. And hopefully you'll join us again for the next edition of the Bruin Podcast as well.